have just rolled out the filing cabinet, and Nigel Rogers, our resident historian, has climbed out. I've sprayed him with Glen 20, so we can go ahead. Good evening, Nigel.
Good evening, Tony. How are you? Thank you for the spray.
Yes, Mark. But more importantly, Ian Love is here, and I've mentioned Ian and some of his history before we came to this discussion, so you know who Ian is in essence anyway. But Ian, I want to ask you a very simple question where I'm sure there is no actual simple answer, but just simply, what the hell are those two words, A and I? What is AI?
Great question, Tony. I will try and give you a simple answer, actually.
Thank you.
We actually see it every day when we use our phone. You know, when we're typing an SMS message or something to somebody, and it brings up this predictive text. That's a form of artificial intelligence. So, in some ways, it's reading your mind. And you know, when people say, "Oh, gee, the last thing I want is some computer to be reading my mind," and you know, that's true. I certainly don't want that.
No.
But that's what it does, and it's predicted. Predictive text is some form of mind reading. You also see it on any sort of social media you're on. When ads come to you, a lot of that's sort of artificial intelligence. So it's I guess another way of very easily describing this, any form of intelligence that isn't sentient being, like a human or any other sentient being.
I get from what I see on television and hear perhaps on radio, and certainly read if I ever read a newspaper ever again, but that there are two schools of thought, or probably many more, but two to me are apparent. One lot saying AI is the roadway to a successful future, and then there's another school of thought saying, just hang on a bit, I don't know how to make it work. Would that be right in my sort of summation?
Yeah, not
of the general view.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a lot of dystopian views of it. You know, things that we see through science fiction movies, popularised in science fiction movies, of the robots coming to take us over and all that sort of
yes.
thing. And then there's the other view where it's you know, it could solve some of humanity's biggest problems, you know, climate change, you know, dementia, cancer, these types of things. So there's definitely a double-edged sword, for sure.
But from your point of view, the human element balanced against the, shall we say, the technological or even the scientific, is that an equal playing field at present?
I think they're just different playing fields. Mm. The deep experts in this area agree on one thing. They agree very consistently, I would say, that this technology could lead to the end of humanity. Okay, that they agree on. And one of the earliest experts to say that was Stephen Hawking in 2015.
So okay, this so has been with us for a while.
This is serious people saying these type of very big statements. They all agree on that. Where they disagree is on how it can be contained, how AI can be brought within human control, or should I say kept within human control.
Okay, take that on board. So can I move that concept back to how does, in this day and age at the moment, does it work? How does AI actually work?
It's essentially... It's a computer. It's software, and it reads data. All data essentially gets broken down into computer code, essentially ones and zeros, and the computers can go through and essentially read things, and over again until it gets essentially the right answer. So that's what's called training. So at the moment, these big tech companies, ChatGPT being one of them, or that's owned by OpenAI, train models, and it costs about $180 to $200 million to train these AIs, and the AI reads copious amounts of information, pretty much anything that's public available on the internet. It reads it and digests it, so that when you ask a question or request it to do something, what comes back is correct. And so they basically learn pretty much in the same they use the terminology neural networks, just like the human brain. So that's basically trying to replicate the way humans do it.
Question that I would have, we often hear people say, you know, a computer's no better than the brain of the programmer. That seems to be not quite the accurate description of what you're talking about.
Okay, so at the moment human beings haven't reached the what they call artificial general intelligence. That's AGI. AGI is a defined, one definition of it, they call the Turing test after Alan Turing. And this is not the perfect one, and people disagree with this, but the Turing test of whether humans have reached AGI or whether the computers have reached artificial general intelligence is that when you're interacting with a computer online, you cannot tell the difference between interacting with a human being or with a computer. So Tony, at the moment, if you and I are chatting over a thing, you know it's a human.
Yes.
And you'd know the difference with a robot, because robot would say, well, press one for this, press two for that. But down the track, when you and I can no longer tell the difference, AI has reached artificial general intelligence.
I've a little experience before. I'm going to ask Nigel about, because you mentioned Turing, and of course he was a great expert on that man. But before we go there, the other day I was trying to get some information across to a company that I deal with, and it's a huge one, covering this whole country. And I was told to go on and to ask the question to the computer, which I did, and came back to me with, please simplify your question. And I did so, or I thought I had, and it came back with the same comment.
Yes.
And so I said, forget it.
Yes.
And because I said, forget it, suddenly we will be giving you, bringing an expert online to talk to you. Well, after three quarters of an hour, I couldn't be bothered waiting for the expert. So that really shows me of some imperfections in the system currently.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I mean, we're sort of, in some ways, we're at the fun stage of AI, but we're also at the dumb stage. Like, they're not that smart. And, you know, it's sort of caveman.
I love your caveman word, Ian. Yes, that's great.
You know, caveman stage.
Nigel, we did mention Turing. Yes, I know you're
You're wearing my history hat. Yeah, I just want to ask Ian to, is it fair to say that, in a way, Alan Turing is the father of artificial intelligence? He built, as you know, when he was at Bletchley Park, cracking Enigma during the Second World War, the German coding system that was used by the military. I mean, he built this huge computer system, which was called the Bomb, after the Poles who initially did work in this area. Would you say he was almost, in a way, the father of artificial intelligence?
Oh, that's a bit beyond my pay grade to say something like that, I think, Nigel.
But many people do believe that.
Look, I think the phrase artificial intelligence was coined by somebody else. So I think and even before Turing, there was Charles Babbage, who is accredited with being the first person to actually create a computer. But Turing is a very, very big. Lots of his work is still very, very relevant today.
So, Ian, could we say then that, in a sense, we've had a certain upsurge in AI as the result of the Second World War, and then now we're building on it into our so-called times of peace, although that's a stretch of the imagination. So it's been accidental in its growth, in one sense?
Yeah, I actually refer to the sort of growth of AI as quite insidious in nature, really.
Right.
Because, and it's hockey stick growth, by the way, as well. So, yes, I think you can trace back, you know, computer developments from Babbage even before then, and certainly code breaking well before then, back to Caesar. And a lot of this stuff is cryptography based. But, you know, just specifically on AI and the sort of hockey stick growth of it over the last sort of decade or two, and even the last 5 years is extraordinary. And beyond AGI, which which they estimate is probably 3 to 4 years away. Beyond that is what they call artificial superintelligence. And at that point, computers are smarter than us. There would be not a human being on the planet that is smarter than the computers. And, that leads to another.
Which brings me to thinking that, and this is why both of you are here to talk about this in the general sense up to now, and then in a moment or two, we'll need to look at that as regards our defence. Mm. Our forces, what the talent is there, whether it's the whole question of the ADF and AI, really. Before I ask you, Nigel, I'd like to pick up on the whole business with our Defence Force situation. Before I do that, Ian, there are probably somebody at home now is thinking, it's a whole lot of rubbish. How would you defend that statement?
I think that's a good way to think. I mean, when I first heard somebody said, AI could lead to the end of humanity, I thought that's just a load of rubbish. Then I listened to read books about the people who had said that, and starting with Stephen Hawking, and I think he does not use his words lightly because he has to speak through a form of artificial intelligence himself. But there's an author. Yuval Harari, who wrote Sapiens, and he's a very good storyteller. And he puts it like this. He says that we've been sort of conditioned through science fiction to believe that for the robots to take over, they need two things that they don't currently have. They need to have sentient feelings, feelings of love and hate and things. Otherwise, why would AI be motivated to take over humanity? And the second thing they need is they need to have physical dexterity. They need to be able to climb trees and swim and chase after humans and things like that. Though that's rubbish.
That's the rubbish.
They don't need that. Yeah. All AI needs to do is to understand language, human language. And because humans love stories, we're storytellers. And if you think about a lot of the military conflicts we've had throughout the history of humanity, and a lot of them on the planet right now, are not driven by, animal instincts and, requests for territory and scarcity of food or anything like that. They're all based on ideas. And so if you can understand people's ideas, you can change their mind. And even in the physical world, we see, laws about hate speech, for example.
Yes.
Okay, and so we can arrest somebody for carrying some sort of flag down the street that we don't like because it's a hate speech thing, and we know how dangerous hate speech can be. How do you arrest an AI for saying something and having hate speech or subtly influencing, billions of people? Each one of them individually in different ways to do things. And so if it learns the language of humanity, the language of humanity is operating system of humanity, and they can twist that against us and destroy us. That's the theory.
So how does that come into things like the AUKUS situation? Or does it? Or am I...
Well, it does. Artificial intelligence will be key. And I think the best thing to do, Tony, let me just talk briefly about Pillar 2 of AUKUS. There are two pillars to AUKUS. Pillar 1 is the acquisition of Australia getting SSN, nuclear-powered attack submarines, including buying some from the United States, Virginia-class submarines. We'll talk about that in a minute. But Pillar 2 is using advanced technology to further develop the capabilities of the ADF in Australia. So I'm just going to, give you a brief summary, as I understand it, on Pillar 2, which is the advanced technology. So I think the first thing, it's important to understand that the development work in this area, for much of it, remains classified. So none of us in this studio, I think, can claim to be experts on it. We can't, because it's classified.
I can claim it, but it wouldn't be true. Yeah.
It's extremely complex and to try and unravel. But the point is, there is a lot of information in the public domain. So, and it's accessible by anybody. Anybody out there can access this information. So all I've done is access this information that's out there on portals and webs and so on. I think it's also important to be clear that the United States and its allies, in this case AUKUS, primarily the UK and Australia, of course, We are in a strategic competition with one country in particular, in which the race to develop and deploy emerging technologies will play a very decisive role. So let's be clear about that. So Pillar 2 of the Trilateral AUKUS Agreement focuses on jointly developing advanced capabilities between three countries and holds the potential to supercharge progress in those areas. So I now acknowledge that I'm quoting from a recent paper published by the US Studies Center at Sydney University. So this is accessible again. So first announced in September 2021, Pillar 2 began with four areas of technological capability: cyber capabilities, now advanced cyber, artificial intelligence, now artificial intelligence and autonomy, quantum technologies, and additional undersea capabilities. Then in April 2022, this list expanded to include a further four areas: hypersonic and counter-hypersonic capabilities, electronic warfare, innovation, and information sharing. So let's break those down quickly. Advanced cyber, in terms of what's happening in progress on this, added in September of 2021 to strengthen cyber capabilities, including protecting critical communications and operation systems. There have been no particular public announcements of progress on this, despite some related projects are underway. So obviously a lot of it remains under wraps. Artificial intelligence, AI and autonomy, emphasised in initial and subsequent joint AUKUS statements to maintain a capability edge and defend against AI-enabled threats by accelerating adoption and improving the resilience of autonomous and AI-enabled systems. And in fact, in April of last year, AUKUS partners conducted a demonstration trial of artificial AI and autonomy in the UK. This was the first publicly announced practical demonstration of progress in Pillar 2. But this saw two world firsts: the live retraining of models in flight and the interchange of artificial intelligence models between AUKUS nations as part of a collaborative swarm to detect and track military targets in real time, and trilateral collaboration within a shared modelling and simulation fund. So they use these models to simulate a warfare, and they used AI to track what they were trying to attack. That's the first kind of use of it being trialled, and that was done in the UK in April last year. Undersea capabilities. Announced at the AUKUS launch in early 2022, statement emphasising advanced trilateral maritime undersea intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance capabilities, and noting that initial trials and experimentation of the AUKUS Undersea Robotics Autonomous Systems project were planned for 2023, but nothing further has been publicly announced. It's obviously still under wraps. Functional areas: information sharing, included in April 2022 to expand and accelerate sharing of sensitive information on agreed areas of advanced capabilities. The importance of robust and novel information sharing was emphasised by the US Secretary of Defence, Lloyd Austin, in a statement in March 2023. And finally, innovation, April 2022, as a new pillar working group to advance the partners' respective defence innovation enterprises and promote knowledge sharing, including encouraging more efficient integration of commercial technologies. There's a lot of companies involved here. You're trying to integrate them all to work together and point in the right direction. So the point is here, there's a lot of things going on. In terms of Pillar 1, Australia is acquiring Virginia-class submarines from the US in 2032, three, possibly five. In 2027, what is known as a submarine rotation west will commence, with US and UK submarines regularly being based out of Western Australia here at Stirling. And with Australia, of course, eventually acquiring SSNs, their nuclear-powered submarines, in collaboration with the UK. They will be built jointly with the UK here in Australia, with many components coming from the UK. The timeline on that is 2040. And in the meantime, the gap is going to be filled by the existing Collins-class submarines. We have six of those, but they are being renovated to take them through for a longer life It's called the Life of Time Extension, LOTE. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot of training going on. There's lots of Royal Australian Navy personnel out there being trained jointly in the UK and the US. But this is huge. This is a huge topic, includes AI.
But can I throw this question, therefore, which is one of my naive ones, to both of you? All of which we heard is extraordinary and mind-boggling, but it all seems to have the common denominator of a human being controlling it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm just being churlish and sort of science fiction mad, the whole AI thing seems to be moving away from that control, and therefore to say your defence forces are doing this, great, on the surface, underneath, who's going to ultimately be in control?
So it's a very astute question. So AI is, certainly when it gets to artificial superintelligence, at that point, it will be the first technologies that humans have created but don't control.
Yeah, that was what was right.
And if you look at nature, there are not many examples in nature where a more intelligent being is under the control of a less intelligent being. The only one I can think of is a mother and child. A baby's cry is designed to alert the mother that the baby needs help. It's a tenuous link sometimes, but it's most of the time it works and pretty strong. But aside from that, intelligent beings control less intelligent beings.
I'm not being facetious here, but I just think of the classic story of the Wizard of Oz, where you had all through it, you think the control is robotic, and then suddenly you get through to the end of it. And it's actually a rather peculiar human being. So I know that sounds silly, but that sort of is the dilemma you must be in.
Well, that's exactly right. That one, obviously, they're talking about the central bankers and sort of in that case. Yeah. And that's a well-known thing. And that's thing. But yeah, it's a bit like that. I think that the fear is that this technology will surpass humans. So, yeah, you're going to have countries with their military going ahead full speed to develop this as much as possible, because they have to. That's their job. Their job is to develop things as fast as possible. You've also got big companies. You know, Microsoft is spending $100 billion on a computer system which is called Stargate, to develop their AI. And Facebook will do the same. These companies will have more power. They already probably have more power than the pharaohs had. You know, they are probably the most powerful institutions that we've ever had. And if they own all the AI, they really almost have a God button, and that's scary. If it escapes that, either escapes the military or escapes the companies, then really it's the humanity against AI, not country versus country.
Because what my tiny pea brain is trying to cope with is the fact that we've just heard from Nigel a whole impressive list of forward thinking in our Defence Force situation. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, are the big companies that are going to be manufacturing the component parts of this? Mm. How much is the supervision from the purchaser, the Defence Force, and how much is the dictation of the companies?
Well, I think, you know, that's a mixture. This is a massive topic just in its own right, in terms of how this will all be managed and controlled. There are many working parties looking at all of this, and obviously industry, companies, will be involved, both here in Australia, the UK, the United States. Trying to coordinate all of that is a massive, massive task. That is what is being worked on currently. But yes, there will be commercial organisations involved. But what is your question more specifically, Tony?
Well, I suppose who ultimately is the top dog?
Well, ultimately, in terms of the military, then obviously the AUKUS pact between Australia, the UK and the United States, senior military people, people running these projects, are ultimately responsible for trying to manage and control that. But, you know, maybe eventually we want to talk about the implications for the Australian Defence Force. Yeah,
I believe so. Yeah. Because, I mean, it seems to me that we often talk of the military are responsible to the government of the day, in our democracies anyway. And yet the politicians will sometimes seem to be looking at things and saying, I don't like it, so I ban it. And that is that going to work as well?
If I can jump in, I don't think the solutions, you know, because if you think about how then if we take it as a given and, for the sake of this argument, that we have, you know, the possibility of AI destroying humanity in a shorter space of time than climate change, you know, thinking about 2040 and having a military ready by then, it's over by then. So if we think
about the time factor's killing
the
that.
This is a very urgent issue because it's accelerating so fast. And once we've got AGI, then computers can start developing themselves. And then with artificial superintelligence, the genie's out of the bottle. We can't, and it cannot put it back in. So where it's going to come from a combination of private sector, but also a lot of independence. So. Charles Babbage and to a certain extent Alan Turing, he was obviously with the British military, but a lot of the people that are working on these things are independent people, cryptographers, computer scientists, mathematicians, and they're working to create seat belts and safety belts to contain this.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
they're not under control of government. The governments haven't asked them to do it. They're not captive by companies. Companies will try and do it, but they've still got their shareholders' interest at stake, really. So we're looking at sort of, and there are very limited numbers of people that have this sort of capability. So that's winging a prayer to a certain extent. But winging a prayer has got us through a few things over time.
Well, I think that's where we might leave it at the moment, because I think we can come back to the winging a prayer with some more time up our sleeve to talk about it. But in the meantime, Nigel, you've got a quote you wanted to make.
Yes, I do have a quote, and to really go down the philosophical road, as it were. I want to talk about somebody called Daniel Dennett, and Anna, my daughter, I've had some discussions with her. She teaches philosophy, amongst other topics, at a university in Sweden. She's a professor there. It's one of her favourite philosophers. So the philosopher Daniel Dennett, he died at the age of 82 in April this year, April the 19th. He was one of the sharpest and most prophetic last half century, not pathetic, prophetic, throughout his life. And he dared to tackle some of the biggest questions about the human mind. And he did an interview with the BBC. And in this BBC interview, before he died, he said to the BBC interviewer the following: if we turn this wonderful technology we have for knowledge into a weapon for disinformation, we are in deep trouble. Why? Because we won't know what we know, and we won't know who to trust, and we won't know whether we're informed or misinformed. We may become either paranoid and hyper-skeptical, or just apathetic and unmoved. Both of these are very dangerous avenues, and they're upon us.
Well, that is really why we were talking about this, yes, on the Listening Post, with its military ramifications, which are just a part of a much, much bigger question, but with the military one uppermost in our minds. I'll say thank you to you, Ian. Thank you again, Nigel. Get back in the filing cabinet, if you would, quickly, before the cleaners come in.
It's probably the safest place.
Yeah, I think it is.
Discussion.
I think it is. And we'll continue this conversation, particularly looking at the future, or positive future, hopefully, with Ian and Nigel next week.